All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor, or actually on the streets here on Michigan Avenue. We are in the Showcase studio. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. It is Thursday. It means Triple Play Thursday, so get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. And we're going to have a visit from Skip Skipley, and pop-up video will be coming later on in the show. And we're going to talk about everything seems to be a remake and a reboot these days. So we're going to talk about the best, the worst, maybe the coolest, or the most unnecessary reboots slash remakes. So that's all coming up. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is that time. Every couple of weeks, we talk with Dan Feinberg, our good friend, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. We talk about television every couple of weeks. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan to the show. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Not bad. Not bad. There's a lot of new stuff that I'm really curious about that you've done reviews for. And there's some stuff that we need to catch up on. I want to mention, I can't believe that Baskets ends next week. It just feels, it just started. It feels like it just started.
And you know what? I feel like we haven't discussed it enough.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how that's even humanly possible because we discuss it every single time I'm on. And yet, I still don't feel like we've discussed it enough.
Yeah, I agree with you. So let's talk a little bit about it. I love the tweet that you sent out last week about last week's episode. Now, the Tuesday night's episode was fantastic. The whole season has been just outstanding. But the episode last Tuesday, I have not laughed that hard out loud at a TV show, well, other than, of course, this last episode of Atlanta, which made me laugh out loud. But Baskets, that whole scene in the costume shop, I was on the floor laughing during that scene.
So not even the fake commercials.
The fake commercials were outstanding, too. I love the fake commercial for the costume shop as well, which I thought was great.
Bar Mitzvah's extra or something? It was all quite wonderful. Like someone had something that they wanted to get out of their system about local commercials in this episode. And bless them for taking the opportunity.
Yeah, and I really just thought it was funny. And of course, again, you know, it has an overwhelming amount of heart, and there's sadness in every episode. But I did, you know, that whole sequence in the costume shop, I seriously was almost on the floor laughing.
I thought that was probably the most laugh-out-loud funny episode of the season, but it's sort of, I think Baskets and Atlanta are very similar in the respect that they're both comedies, because we have to call them comedies because they're 23 minutes,
right.
They air in a half-hour format, so of course they're comedies, but their funniest episodes sometimes are not their best episodes, and sometimes their best episodes can be half funny and then half deadly serious, and sometimes an episode that can be funny if you take a step back from it can also be really, really painful and excruciating. Like last week's Atlanta hurt me.
Yeah.
It was so hard watching Earn and his money for the entire episode. It was like, oh God, this is so bad. Stop, stop. And I think if you take two steps back, you can go, okay, that's really, really hilarious. And in the process of the moment, that episode was nothing but sheer pain and anxiety for a character we care about. And I think that's sort of the brilliance of both of these two shows, is the way that they co-mingle real pain and anxiety with ha-ha-ha, let's laugh with and at our characters.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, at that Atlanta episode, the whole $100 bill thing, I just, as you were saying, man, it kept getting worse and worse and worse. The strip club sequence is just ridiculous. And you're right, it was very painful, but it was also really funny.
It's one of those things that the show does well, and it sometimes wants to and sometimes doesn't, because it doesn't feel the need to be the same show from week to week, but one of my favorite modes that the show goes into is kind of the the urn as either the main character in the Odyssey or in Dante's Inferno. The idea that you sort of follow this character as he goes down and down and down and through this city over the course of 23 minutes. And it's something that you can do so well with the character as Donald Glover plays him, because he's so... his name is Earn, and he's so earnest at times. He really just wanted to spend his money. That was all he wanted to do, is he had some money he wanted to spend, and no one would let him spend his money.
Yeah.
And both beautiful and also really, really funny.
Yeah.
We've got many more episodes of Atlanta still to go, but the fact that Baskets ends next week is truly sad, and I like to believe that your listeners are basically 99% of them are watching Baskets because of these conversations, and it's like this little intense pocket of Baskets love that FX can actually see.
Yeah. And the episode from the other night was just great, and it ended on such a ridiculous note. Dale is out of the episode pretty much the entire episode. He's not there, and then he just pops in at the end with this ridiculous subplot that hatches itself, and the whole Martha birthday party thing. Oh my God.
And it's funny, because the thing is, when I think of Bakersfield, California, Basque food really is legitimately the thing that I think of most frequently, because my family used to stop there in cross-country drives for Basque food.
Is that right?
It is absolutely and totally and earnestly a thing. And so I'm happy that the show got to stick around long enough for this weird cultural pocket that really and truly exists to actually come and be a story point. So
yeah.
I was extremely happy that really the only thing I think of legitimately when I think of Bakersfield got to make its way into Basket.
Well, that's interesting, because I didn't know. You know, I've never been. And, I just found it to be weird and strange, but the fact that it is a real thing, is that adds to it.
It is absolutely a strange and weird thing about Bakersfield, and they found a way to make use of it. And I think it is a true thing that Baskets kind of has this nightmarish view of Bakersfield, but it also has kind of begrudging respect for it. It's not quite on the same level that you really truly feel Greta Gerwig's affection for Sacramento in Lady Bird,
right?
You know, where you actually get a feeling that the filmmaker loves the city. I don't think that anyone associated with Baskets loves Bakersfield, but I think they don't view it as being an accidental place where they set the show, and every once in a while they like to remember that.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I also, some major heartbreaking stuff in it, and this time involving Martha, not so much Christine, but I really wanted to see, and I hope we do get to see Chip play Dill Pickles. I was hoping to get to see him show off his new character. I really wanted to see it. I mean, the pants and the outfit were enough. I laughed every time he tried to sit in a booth or at a table. It made me laugh, but I really did want to see Dill Pickles. So.
But wouldn't it be the most appropriate thing if you only saw enough of Dill Pickles to believe that he might actually be the character that would be a breakthrough character for Chip, and then you didn't see any more of it? You never saw the character actually in action.
Yeah, no, that would be funny. Well, either way they go, I'm on. You know, I'm on board with whatever happens. I'm just, you know, when I watched the episode Wednesday morning yesterday morning, and it was... You know, I mean, I loved it. I thought it was great. And then at the end, when they show a preview for next week and it said season finale, I audibly just went, oh, I was like, no, it can't be over already. So only 10 episodes.
Yeah, but it's only been 10 episodes for the first two seasons as well. It's a kind of micro batch show. And there's a surprising number of things that are going away at this moment. Several of my favorite ABC comedies have also had their finales this week, Fresh Off the Boat and Speechless both, and it feels much too soon for that. It feels too soon for things to be ending, and fortunately there's a lot of very good TV that's about to start up again, and really I don't think anyone should ever worry about a lack of TV.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's a possibility. It's just that when really, really good stuff goes away, it upsets me. And Baskets is really, really good. So, so
agreed.
Yeah. What's replacing those ABC shows?
Various different other ABC shows. So they have Alex Inc., which brings Zach Braff back to TV, because it's the story of a man starting a podcasting empire that America has been waiting to dive into, and it's not awful. It's just okay. So that's taking one of the two time slots, and then splitting up together with Jenna Fisher and Oliver Hudson.
Oh, right. And have you seen that? How many episodes of that have you seen?
I've seen three episodes, and it is a great vehicle for Jenna Fisher. And I know you like Jenna Fisher.
I do very much. Yeah.
So it is a great vehicle for Jenna Fisher. It is. It's kind of a flimsy show. I would say it's an extremely flimsy show. The premise is that this couple, they agree to that they're getting a divorce, they're separating, but they can't afford to sell the house in the housing market, so they take alternating weeks, one in the house babysitting, well, not really babysitting, parenting the kids, and the other is just in the guest house, and they swap back and forth, and wouldn't you know it, there are conflicts in that arrangement, and also, wouldn't you know it, they're really still deeply in love, even though they're separated, and will they find ways to become better people separate so that they can be better people together or something? Anyway, Jenna Fisher's great. Oliver Hudson's not bad, actually. It's just such a flimsy premise for a show, and in the three episodes I've seen, it hasn't exactly deepened it. But I'm happy to see Jenna Fisher in sort of a starring role, given that the last thing I saw her do on TV was the pilot for the Matt LeBlanc show that she was then recast out of, where it was one of those examples where you could actually see the dislike and animosity between the stars on the screen.
Oh, wow.
It was a weird and uncomfortable thing, and they recast it, and the show is now in its second season, so obviously it's doing fine. Part of it had to do with the way that the characters were written, but you also could sense that just neither actor knew how they were supposed to be playing it opposite each other, and it was very sad. This is a much better part for her, even if the show is not necessarily on her level.
Okay. Well, I think she's great, so I will definitely be watching that. Okay, Dan, hang on, okay?
For sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We have a link on our Facebook page as well. We'll take a quick break for the news, and then after the news, more TV talk with Dan right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We are live in the Allstate Showcase Studio right here on Michigan Avenue. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday, one artist, three songs. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Also, Skip Skipley's on the way. We will have another edition of Pop-Up Video, and we're going to talk about good, bad, and necessary and unnecessary reboots and remakes, because that's what everybody sees nowadays. So we'll get into that. Right now, though, we are in the middle of our discussion with Dan Feinberg, who joins us every 2 weeks. To talk TV. He's a critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
All right. I want to talk about one show and then segue into another one. The last couple of weeks, it's been a couple of weeks since we've talked, last couple of weeks of SNL I thought were both really strong shows. And I thought Sterling K. Brown did a great job on his episode, because we were both, you know, looking forward to that. What did you think?
I thought that when they let him do things, he did a great job, and I thought he was a predictably magnificent sport, and every once in a while they did things that I thought were really, really good with him, and then they did things that were sort of lazy and unamusing with him. So certain things, like I thought the Ben Carson thing was not really all that funny or necessary. They did the Family Feud in that episode, right?
Where Yes, they did.
And those sketches, they're always just, okay, everybody do your 30 seconds of impressions.
Right.
And I'm always vaguely amused by them. I'm never sure why exactly they have to be as early in the show as they are, given that they never have a joke. But I don't know that I had known that he had what I don't know that I had known what a common impression would look like
yeah.
coming from Sterling K. Brown.
Yeah.
And I kind of bought that. No, so he's always a good sport, and I am happy for Sterling K. Brown. He could have done more if they'd wanted to. And Bill Hader, he was Bill Hader. What you going to say? Yeah. You know, you bring out a few of those characters, and I am happy to spend time with them. As a Californian myself, I am amused by the Californians. I know that some people utterly detest that sketch. It always makes me laugh.
Yeah,
and mostly you bring out Stefan, and I'm gone.
Stefan is. I mean, the Stefan segment was hilarious. I thought Mulaney's cameo was hysterical. That's gold. Every single time Stefan is gold. I thought the sketch where he played the old man in the motorized wheelchair with Cecily Strong on top, I laughed my ass off during that. And a lot of course, has to do with, you know, Bill Hader running into people with the stupid cart, and Melissa Villaseñor being like crushed between the chair and the table. All of that stuff just cracked me up.
I liked that one, but I thought that to me felt like a vintage 1250.
Oh yeah.
And I wasn't sure why it was so early in the show. It totally, if that had been the last sketch of the night,
yeah,
I would have thought it was brilliant and brilliantly placed, because it would have just let everyone go off in their in their weird giggles for the last 10 minutes of the show, because that's all it was. It was everybody just cracking up.
Right.
You know, it was Cecily Strong losing it constantly, and Hader losing it constantly, and all of that. That was all the sketch was. Let's see, what else was in the episode? Pete Davidson's thing about Kevin Love. His Weekend Update appearances to talk about his mental state have been so cutting and so real in a way that, frankly, very little else on the show is.
Yeah.
And they're amazing, because they really are from a completely different showcase, where he just gets to come out and give a little corner of what's happening in his head every few weeks, and you just go, God, okay, that's a dark place to spend time.
Yeah.
But B, he is trying to get help, and he's trying to use this as a vehicle, and he's trying to use it as a vehicle to talk to people. And it's impressive to me what he is doing.
I agree with you 100%. I think it's great, and it's the best stuff. Obviously, it's the best stuff that he does on the show when he does those update appearances. How did you feel about the "Kiss Me, I'm Irish" dating game sketch?
I thought it was not a joke that went very deep, but I thought it was a joke that made its point, got a few laughs, and ended. And I, every once in a while, I appreciate when a sketch sort of has a beginning, middle, and end, and walks away.
Yeah.
And I felt that was a sketch that had that. I would not necessarily need to revisit that world at any point.
Right.
But I laughed two or three times and it was gone. And so I liked that. I like it when a sketch can do that.
Yeah, I thought it was actually really funny. And Cecily Strong's Irish accent is fantastic. And the fact that she also got to do the Aer Lingus bit with Saoirse Ronan was pretty great. And I was thinking of that while watching the Kiss Me, I'm Irish thing, which I thought was very funny. So that's the Bill Hader episode. So Bill Hader, see, I'm segueing.
I see.
Has a new show on HBO that I am so excited about, and I really, really, really hope it's good. It's called Barry. Tell everybody about it.
Barry is co-created by Bill Hader and Alec Berg, who is also one of the co-creators on Silicon Valley. And the premise is that Bill Hader plays basically a former military sharpshooter veteran who returned to the family home with no jobs and was sort of rooked into working as a hired assassin, as you do. And so he gets sent out to Los Angeles on a hit that involves some random Eastern European mob, sort of an in over your head kind of thing. And he finds himself in an acting class that's taught by Henry Winkler, just observing the person he's planning on killing. And in the moment, he realizes a sense of camaraderie and approval that maybe he hasn't felt in his ordinary life, and he becomes intrigued by the possibilities of setting aside his life as a hitman to become a struggling actor in Los Angeles. And that is the premise of Barry. And it is at times far darker and more serious than people maybe are expecting it to be. And at times it is loopy and crazy and exactly what people are expecting it to be. Bill Hader is super in it. He really does have the ability to do thoroughly dramatic work when he's asked to, and also is very funny. Henry Winkler is marvelous. Stephen Root plays sort of Barry's, I don't know, hitman pimp, I guess, would be sort of a description of what he does. He arranges the hits for him and realizes that his meal ticket is straying from the thing he does well and tries to make sure he stays on the fold. There are a lot of familiar character actors who pop up here and there. But yeah, it's really good, and it takes a premise that you would think could be thin, and it finds a way to do different and resilient things with it. And so, you know, it makes a lot of pretty easy jokes about the L.A. acting community, but it makes them in smarter ways than it needs to. It has some relatively dramatic and well-shot action scenes as well, because, you know, he is a hitman, and Hader directed a bunch of the episodes. He directed the first three episodes, and this appears to be a skill that he possesses. And yeah, it's really, really promising. I've seen four episodes. My colleague Tim wrote the actual review, and he's seen all eight. And I've heard from several people who have seen the full season of eight episodes that it gets better and better and better. So I've seen four, and it's very good, and I'm looking forward to seeing the other four.
I am so excited about it. It's a half an hour, correct?
Yep, half hour, and it's, again, only eight episodes in the first season, so it's not going to overstay its welcome, and that is good. Bill Hader directed three of the episodes. Alec Berg directed a couple. Hiro Murai, who's one of the primary directors on Atlanta, directed a couple of the other episodes. So it's a good group of people who know how to do direction that bridges a gap between some drama but also kind of crazy silliness. And I think that This is the kind of show that could really help Henry Winkler break out. So I think that would be a nice side effect. No, he's very funny. He plays sort of this, you know, basically plays a Hollywood acting teacher, and you've seen that kind of thing before. But it's very inspired in its silliness and in its self-seriousness, and he does it perfectly, and he has a very nice rapport with Bill Hader, and that's sort of the core of the show, I think.
That's great. Well, I'm glad to hear that it's very good, because I think Bill Hader is great. And you know, when I saw the first trailers for it, I was like, wow, this is really kind of a departure, you know, for Hader, because, you know, and then I saw Bill Hader, you know, he's obviously making the rounds on the late night shows, you know, promoting this. And said that he just went to HBO with the idea of, like, me as a hitman. And they just looked at him like, what? Like, Bill Hader as a hitman? And then they okayed it and let him do what he wanted. So, which I just think is great.
He's an interesting actor. And I think he's the kind of actor who really and truly over the next 10 or 15 years, it's going to be so interesting to see what it is that he wants to do, because I think he could do basically anything he wants to. He could become a completely straight dramatic actor if that was the direction he wanted to go, and I would be unsurprised if he did that and was nominated for Oscars in the next 10 years. But he also could decide that he wants to do the crazy things, and he wants to do comedy, and he could just as easily become the star of a broadcast network sitcom that ran for 10 years. So I think it's a question of what does Bill Hader want to do with his career, because he's a talented guy.
He's a very talented guy, and I'm glad to hear that he does well behind the camera, because they talked about that. He and Seth talked about that. Seth Meyers talked about him directing, and that he was very excited about it. But he also told a story about how he was directing Henry Winkler in a scene, and Henry Winkler was being because Henry Winkler is Henry Winkler, he was being too nice within the scene. And so Hader gave him the direction to just, you know, to be meaner. You got to be meaner to this woman. You got to be meaner to her. And so Henry Winkler says, "Wait, are you saying that this guy is an a-hole?" And Hader says, "Yeah." And then the next take, he went nuts, and Winkler went off, and like people on the set were actually scared. They kind of freaked out. So I guess that probably shows up on the show.
Winkler is very good, and of course you can't have anyone in the world discuss Henry Winkler and working with Henry Winkler without people describing him as the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah.
None of my experiences with him have ever suggested otherwise.
Yeah.
So they have a very good behind the camera rapport. You know,
yeah.
they came to TCA press tour, and seeing them go back and forth, you can see how they work together.
That's great. That's really great. So looking forward to that. That's Sunday night on HBO. Before we break here, I do want to mention, you know, Hader is obviously an exceptional comedic performer and has got amazing range in that world. But the first time when I realized that, like, he could be what you described as a guy who could be a serious actor and maybe win some Academy Awards was the Skeleton Twins. Because I think his performance in the Skeleton Twins is so good and really sweet and beautiful and funny. That's where I went, oh, boy, okay, so this guy's not just sketch comedy. He could be the real deal.
I think if people have watched the stuff that he's done on Documentary Now over a couple
of years. Oh, yeah.
He's just done so many different things, and some of them are completely and totally straight. You know, they're 100% serious, and it's only the absurdity of the context around them that makes them funny. He really can do just about anything, and the question is what he wants to do and what, you know, obviously what Hollywood wants to let him do. So it would certainly help if this is a success for him, and it's a good show, so I hope it will be.
Okay. Hang on, Dan, all right?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. Barry is the show with Bill Hader, and it's on HBO premiering on Sunday night. We're going to take a break. We have a lot more TV to talk about right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And also, that's Talk and Text for you. You can check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Dan Feinberg is with us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. More TV to talk about right now with Dan. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
All right. So we were talking about some of the shows that I'm really looking forward to. We talked about Barry already. I'm also really interested in looking forward to The Last OG, which is Tracy Morgan's new show. Tell us about that one.
I would tell you, first of all, to get a little bit less excited or to lower your expectations.
Okay.
That would be the first thing I would advise, because it's a show that sort of is arriving with this surprising pedigree that TBS doesn't really know what to do with. The basic premise is Tracy Morgan plays a former low-level drug dealer and sort of street guy from Brooklyn who got sent away to jail for 15 years on the night of the first American Idol finale. And now, 15 years later, he's getting out, and he returns to Brooklyn, and he's shocked to discover the effects of gentrification have impacted not only the neighborhood which he once knew, but also his ex-girlfriend, played by Tiffany Haddish, who has become a much, much more legitimate woman, right down to a hipster white husband, and they are together raising the two twin 15-year-old kids that Tracy did not know he left behind. And that is basically the premise, is Tracy, or Trey, as his character is in this, trying to reacclimate himself to the world that has changed without him and to the ex who left him behind but probably still has feelings for him, and getting to know the children he didn't know he had, etc. And it's all, to some degree, a veiled metaphor or allegory for Tracy Morgan's own career and for the time that he lost after the accident that nearly claimed his life, however many years ago that was. And so there's that dark undercurrent of sadness that carries through even if the show doesn't necessarily want it to. And so I already mentioned Tiffany Haddish, and that's a pretty big get for a basic cable show at this particular moment.
Yeah.
Obviously, at the time that they signed her on, she was not America's sweetheart, Tiffany Haddish. And it also just so happens that the series was co-created by a certain former sketch comedy writer named Jordan Peele,
right,
who I believe has also raised his profile in recent
years. A little bit. An Oscar will do that.
It will. And so, yeah, so these are a lot of people who sort of raise expectations, and the series itself is really kind of a mess. And it has these interesting moments of kind of introspection and trying to work around what are Tracy Morgan's current limitations as an actor. He's significantly better than he was when he had his SNL guest appearance a couple of years ago, when you could really, really see, you know, the things he couldn't do.
Yeah.
But he's not as physical an actor as once he was. He doesn't necessarily have the volume control, and he was always an actor who liked to work in very, very broad and frequently loud strokes.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have the modulation down as much. And so the show is a lot of trying to figure out how to make him funny, or for how he can be funny, but also how he can be serious and then people around him can be funny. So a lot of the time, Cedric the Entertainer, who plays the guy who runs the halfway house that Trey is living in, he has to sort of come in and pick up a lot of the more obviously comedic shtick. The show feels like a show where when they started making it, they didn't know what they were able to make, and as they're going along, they're figuring it out. I've seen 6 episodes, and I'm not sure that after 6 episodes they've figured it out.
Mm.
But it really is kind of somewhat fascinating on an intellectual level to watch and see the tinkering as they go along. You can't see that on every show, and I don't know that necessarily most people would want to see that on every show, but you can kind of sense that down the road there might be a good show. Here, it's not there immediately, and so it's a little tough to watch at
okay.
the beginning.
All right.
So, but you know, adjust expectations, and maybe it will live down to them.
Okay, and that debuts that's on TBS, and that debuts on the 3rd.
Yes,
April 3rd. So,
if you've been watching any NCAA tournament basketball, you've seen many, many, many ads.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, Dan, hang on.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is hanging out with us, and we're going to talk a little bit more about TV. Always a lot of TV to talk about with Dan. You can read him at The Hollywood Reporter, and you can also follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We got the news coming up now, and then after the news, more TV talk with Mr. Feinberg right after this on 720 WGN. All right. Hey, good morning, everyone. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live here in the Allstate Showcase Studio right on Michigan Avenue. We're here till 5 o'clock every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. And today is Triple Play Thursday, so get your requests in, one artist, 3 songs. And that's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. The Pigeons and the Penguins have been released, and Skip Skipley is on his way. We will have another match between Esmeralda and I playing some pop-up video. That's coming up as well. We're going to talk about remakes and reboots, good, the bad, the ugly, all of that kind of stuff, because there are reboots and remakes everywhere in the world, and we'll talk about that. Right now, though, we are talking with Dan Feinberg, who joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
All right. So we got to talk about Roseanne returning. And so
I feel like so many people are approaching it in exactly that way.
Yeah.
Do we have to talk about Roseanne? Oh, I guess we got
to. I guess we have to talk about Roseanne. How many have you seen? Have you seen the whole season?
No, I have seen 3, which apparently is 3 of 9. And I think I've seen the first, second, and 7th episode.
Oh, that's
those were the ones that they decided to send. That's, you know, it's Roseanne. It's not like it's deeply serialized. I was very much able to figure out what was still going on in the show in the 7th episode.
Okay.
So,
right.
no problems there. The first episode is the one that, that people have been sort of grumbling or rumbling with discomfort about in recent months already because of the inevitability of Roseanne's character on the show being a Trump supporter and how much exactly that would turn out to be a key plot point in the show or in the series in general. And the answer is it's definitely a key plot point in the first episode that Roseanne did indeed vote for Trump and that Aunt Jackie is not happy about that. So there's a lot of clashing and it's a little uncomfortable to watch if you don't necessarily want to be in the middle of that discussion.
Yeah.
My theory on it is that's what Roseanne is supposed to be doing. If Roseanne is not making you feel like it's confronting things that families go through in America, then it's not doing its job. And I thought in general that this was, to go with one of the themes of your show tonight, this was a reboot or a revival that where you could see why they were doing it. You could see how this was saying, okay, here's what the life of the Connor family looks like in 2017, 2018. Here's how it makes sense based on what the family's life was before, with the exception of the fact that you thought that Dan was dead and he's not dead anymore.
How did they handle that?
That basically the very first joke of the entire premiere pilot, whatever, is Dan waking up with a sleep apnea mask and Roseanne staring at him and going, "I thought you were dead," and him saying, "Why does everyone always think I'm dead?" And that's basically what
it is.
I think the implication that's always been made was that the last season of Roseanne was kind of the book that she was writing and that he died in the book she was writing, not in real life.
And
that's sort of been what they've always kind of implied. But no one ever just comes out and says it, which I think I appreciate because, you know, you don't want to spell that stuff out too much. But so there are a couple jokes about it in the very first scene. There's another joke that's tossed out later, but mostly life goes on, as it were. And similarly, original Becky is back to being Becky, but Sarah Chalk, who was second Becky, as everyone calls her, she has a key role playing a woman who's trying to get Becky to carry her child as a surrogate, and so there are many jokes about whether they look exactly alike, and that's sort of a thing that the show does a little bit. But it doesn't like go full Fuller House where it's only references to the original series and to things that people are thinking about the show. It mostly just becomes, okay, here's this show that about this family that struggled and did the best it could to advance through the 80s and the 90s, and here's how they're doing their best to make it in, you know, a new millennium. And that's and it works reasonably well, and Roseanne is you know, she's a solid sitcom star, and John Goodman is fantastic, and Sarah Gilbert is so good, and I think so underappreciated. I hope, if nothing else, this makes people look and go, "Wow, this was basically a child star," even if she came from, you know, Hollywood royalty of some sort. But you know, she was a child star,
yeah,
who did this thing as a kid that was very impressive as a kid. And she's still really good, and you can't say that for all the other Connor children. Basically, Sarah Gilbert's the one who's awesome still, and I think the show steers a lot into it in this new incarnation, is reminding you of how good Sarah Gilbert is. Of course, Laurie Metcalf is great, etc. So I think it still has reasons to exist. Whether I'm going to watch it on a weekly basis, I can't say for sure. There's a lot of darn TV, Nick, yeah. And even when Roseanne was in its peak, it was never a show that I watched every week religiously. It was a show that I watched sometimes and sometimes appreciated, and I think probably the revival works as that as well.
Okay. Yeah, I was never, I mean, I watched it, like you, I watched it casually. I was not it was not a show that I watched religiously. And when I did watch it, I enjoyed it. And I particularly John Goodman. I always really loved John Goodman on that show. And Laurie Metcalf is a national treasure and always has been. So, did we talk about this, about how someone actually wrote, and I think it was in the New Yorker, when she got nominated for Lady Bird, someone wrote a piece which the headline was something like, "Who knew Laurie Metcalf had all this range?" And now, being a Chicagoan who has seen her on stage for many years, my head almost exploded. It's like, where the hell have you been? Clearly written by a person who only watched Roseanne. So
it's sort of medium snobbery. There was a blurb from The Guardian, I think, that was on all the posters for I, Tonya, and the blurb called Alice and Janney a revelation. And I'm like, seriously? how on earth, after 8 Emmy wins for sitcoms, dramas,
yeah,
for doing absolutely everything, what could Alice and Janney have to reveal to you
right
at this point?
Right.
That she can act with a parrot? That's right. Not enough. Similarly, anyone who looks at Laurie Metcalf right now and goes, oh, really? I didn't know she could do that.
Oh, my God.
That just means you haven't been paying attention.
No, you haven't been paying attention.
Admit.
And you haven't been paying attention. And maybe I reacted to it more strongly because I'm a Chicagoan, but it made me nuts when I read it. It just made me nuts.
Sure. No, that's the kind of thing that would make my head explode.
Yeah.
I haven't followed her whole career on the stage in Chicago, but I saw her in London in Long Day's Journey and Tonight.
Oh.
She's phenomenal. There is anyone who does not know that Laurie Metcalf is phenomenal, and frankly, that she should have won the Oscar.
I agree.
This year.
But, I agree. You know, I loved Alice and Janney. I thought Alice and Janney was great in I, Tonya. I really did, obviously. But that performance in Lady Bird that Laurie Metcalf gives is just, it's wonder. It's so extraordinary and so great.
And if anything, actually, seeing Laurie Metcalf going back to
We're always looking
Aunt
towards
Jack,
the future.
This Roseanne
and inspired.
Role, it really makes me go, okay, I know she's better than this. Mm-hmm. And, she won 3 Emmys for Roseanne. She was toasted and decorated and hailed. And yet I watched her performance in the 3 episodes I've seen of the revival, and I go, okay, well, of course she can do this. I knew she can do this, but I also know she can do much more, and it'd be great if they let her do it. And
that's
just not really what the show is geared towards. It's not going to let her do advanced dramatic acting
right
on Roseanne. And so you have to accept that this is a corner of talent that she has without question, but she's got so much more.
Have they taken Horace and Pete away? Can no one see that anymore? Because that episode with Laurie Metcalf is extraordinary, and I realize that people are now don't want to watch anything associated with Louis C.K. But her performance in that particular episode was obviously unbelievable.
Oh, it remains galling to me that she did not win an Emmy for that, and she unquestionably should have. Yeah, I don't know if it's currently available or if it simply vanished along with everything else Louis C.K. related, and I don't know if there's an answer for at what point any of it is allowed to come back.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's saying, when do we welcome Louis C.K. back into our life and when do we forgive him? Because I'm not saying that. But
no.
What I'm saying is the things that were art, do they ever get to come back? Does Louis ever get to come back as a TV show? Because that show on FX was a magnificent show.
Yes.
And does Horace and Pete get to come back? It was a magnificent show. And I'm not talking coming back for new seasons. I'm just talking,
right,
they become available again, or
right,
are they hidden away in a place where they can't be seen?
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer to that. That's for programmers and other people and other gatekeepers. But I would like to believe that the art will someday be able to be seen again.
Yeah.
Who knows?
And it's too bad if it never gets seen again, because if you missed Laurie Metcalf on that episode of Horace and Pete, my God, it was breathtaking. So, is there anything that you wanted to mention that you would like to recommend to people? We got a couple minutes here.
It's just amazing because, here we are, we have this time to talk about all this TV, and there are so many things to talk about, and so I had no idea of which things you were going to mention. There are like 15 other things you could have mentioned, and
right,
there's just so much. So, people should watch Wild Wild Country on Netflix, which I mentioned back at Sundance when I came back from Sundance, a 6-part documentary series about the cult that took up residency in Oregon in the early 80s. It's a true story. It's gripping. It's great.
Okay.
Let's see. On my block, Netflix has had this insane run of great young adult shows. in recent months.
Yeah.
And so everything sucks, and the end of the bleeping world, and of course things like American Vandal and Stranger Things. And On My Block is kind of a rougher show than a lot of those. It's a high school show about incoming freshmen who live in an LA crime-ridden neighborhood, and they're just trying to make their way in a rough neighborhood by hanging together as four friends. It's funny, it's a little loopy, it's dramatic, it's really good. If you didn't think that All the Money in the World told the Getty story in the way you want, Trust premieres this weekend on FX, and Donald Sutherland blows the doors off of what Christopher Plummer was able to do.
I've been seeing that in the commercial and in the commercials for it. And Donald Sutherland, man. I mean, he's the man. And I'm looking forward to seeing that one, too.
So that's coming this weekend. And then, of course, The American starts up again next week.
Yes.
And then, of course, there's Siren on Freeform. It's about a mermaid. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but we haven't had a good mermaid TV show in a few years. So I'm looking forward to that. Stuff for everyone.
All right. There you go. I have a feeling that we're going to be seeing more mermaids and merman, considering what won Best Picture. So maybe that is
true. I hadn't even thought that really it's all just about Splash Revival.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Dan, always a pleasure, my friend, and always cool. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Everybody can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN. We'll talk to you next time.
Till the next time, Nick.
All right, buddy. Take care. There you go. Dan Feinberg, everybody. Again, follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN. He joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV, and you can read him at The Hollywood Reporter. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to start talking about reboots and remakes, remakes that were great, remakes that were bad, and everything in between. All right, we'll take a break. 312-981-7200 is the phone number.